Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the incredible Creekside Room, today's speaker is Verlon Brown, and he will be speaking on violence against men. So let's listen in on Verlon Brown.
It's based on a number of readings and stuff I've gathered from a number of books, but the two main sources are Warren Farrell's two books, one entitled Why Men Are the Way They Are, the other entitled The Myth of Male Power. And so today, what I thought I'd do is I'd just kind of run through. How many of you have never been here before to my class? I mean? Okay. What I thought I'd do is run through everything we went through, and then together we'll break up into small groups. We're already a small group. We'll break up into smaller groups and come up with solutions to these things. So those of you who were here before can help me out at this point, and we'll go through. We'll go through what we've already been through quickly, just to inform those who haven't been here. First, we'll do the four P's. Who knows what those are?
Okay.
Pursue.
Perform.
Protect.
Protect.
Okay. Let's see. Woman is victim. What's something else that we covered? And I'll just go over this all at once for everybody. Woman is victim. Something else comes to mind that we talked about that particularly struck people?
Men are disposable. Okay. Men get all the dangerous jobs.
Okay.
Differences in options.
Okay.
Yeah, the three options that men and women have.
Okay, disposable men. Output. Her three options. What else?
Power versus powerlessness.
Okay.
Talk about stage one, stage two.
Okay.
Survival versus hope.
Women don't know what men won't say.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Let me think about that.
Women, he says women can't hear.
That's right.
What men don't say. I'll put in rape here. I need to say a little something about that. What else can people think of that we touched on? Okay, well, I'll start on I'll start with this, and then maybe this will stimulate other ideas. The first one, pursue, perform, protect. This is what all men have to do in order to be considered a suitable prospect for women. If we don't pay, pursue, perform, or protect, we're left out in the cold as far as women are concerned. And then we get into men as success objects.
Success objects.
Objects, yeah. You know, like men will, a woman walks down the street, men will say, wow, look at those knockers. If a man walks down the street, women will say, wow, look at that wallet. And that men, women use men as success objects. He talks about a woman, it's nothing for a woman to say, I met the nicest doctor today. Or I met this really neat guy who happens, you know, he's a lawyer. That's acceptable, but if men say, you know, I met this real nice, large-breasted woman, you know, everybody takes issue.
That's because women are born the way they are, is how big their breasts are, no matter what. And a doctor is something you do.
Yeah, a doctor is something you do, but not everybody does the doctor thing, you know. So, that once again fits into here, and that points out what he considers part of the powerlessness of men is because women are accepted for what they are physically, but men have to do this in order for women to look at us.
Verlon, can I say something about this?
Yeah.
Because I think that what you're saying, this is the message of society. It comes out of the structure of how we organize life here. Men are supposed to do something and women are supposed to do something. And one, I mean, I don't think it's genetic, and I also think it sort of means that it's not just physical characteristics. And the best example I can think of is that I remember that there's a society in several South Pacific islands where women, in fact, treat men as drones. They admire them for their bodies. Men spend all of their time trying to become desirable objects, to be invited in, to get a chance to be fathers. And the thing that I had forgotten, but is crucial, is everybody agrees women have all the power in that society. The men agree and the women agree, and men are worthless. And it's very interesting to see the field. I mean, but you would think, if you didn't know who was talking, and you couldn't see him, you'd say, that's our society, you just label it wrong. But the crucial thing is the reason women have all the power is because they control the food. And the entire economy depends on who raises the food. Men do nothing. There is no place for them. Women are the food raisers. They pay. And so in their society, the equivalent of the paying or the wallet is, I can feed you. And in fact, men can die of starvation if they don't, in the end, succeed in getting handouts or being attractive enough. So that makes me think it's societal. I mean, it's an organizational thing that you could swap with gender, but we still have roles that work like this.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is roles, it is society, but let me say once again that this is old stuff.
Right.
This is not just American stuff. This is old stuff. And by that I mean that, you know, part of it is it seems to be in our makeup as humans. In societies where women, societies that are not, you know, what we term patriarchal, are societies that have enough food, have enough water, and there's no threat of being taken over by war. And then the men become like everybody else. They don't become warriors. He uses an example of Scandinavia, that the Vikings were deadly people. They used to take pride in how they could take a sword and cut a person's body in half with one swipe. And nobody of today thinks of Danes and Swedes and Norwegians in that sense anymore. And for the very reason that they have enough food, they have enough water, and they've arranged their society to the point where there's not a prevailing threat of them being taken over by war. That when that happens, that it kicks, this old stuff kicks in, and men become the protectors and go out and do the killing. Okay? women as victims. He says, as long as we see women as victims, and men as predators, that society will be unequal. It puts us in a stage of adolescence, because adolescent boys think that women are sugar and spice and everything nice, and that if you think of women only like that, then you miss the whole picture, and that we need to get beyond seeing women as innocent victims, you know, in the sense that everything happens to women, and that men are ogres, and we have all of this power. And one of the ways of getting at that is talking about disposable men. And I gave a list of what he considers disposable men. 85% of all the people in America who are homeless are men. Prisons, you know, there are a lot more men in prison than there are women in prison. He talks about diseases. Men die of the 15 leading diseases that kill people at a rate higher than women. Men's suicide rate is higher than women. He talks about the death professions that men go into: firemen, policemen, garbage collector, coal miner, construction worker. All of those are death professions, have a very high rate of death associated with those jobs. All of our presidents and leaders who have been assassinated or taken as hostages have been men. For the past 50 years, there's only been 3 women executed. The rest have all been men. Only men are drafted into war. Only men have to go into combat, you know.
But men kill more people than women do.
Men kill more people than women do, and he says that's because men are trained to be killers.
Right.
He says men are trained by society, not just men, but by everybody, to be killers. He says when cheerleaders jump around and scream and shout for a man who listens, as much as they jump around and scream and shout for a man who smashes faces on the football field, then men will have, young boys will have incentive to grow up to be men who listen, as opposed to men who kill. Her three options is one. Her three options is she can work full time, she can work part time, take care of the children, or she can work, not work at all, and take care of the children. His options are work.
That's changing.
Changing, yeah, but not. Yes, it's changed. But for a lot of people, when they talk about, you know, when you think about the successful woman, it's the person who has those three options. It's not the person who has to work. So the person with the options are still, you know, still the model of success. Listen, do you want to say something?
Well, I was going to say that it's also an issue about stage 1, stage 2, which we'll talk about later, that at the low end of the economic scale where you're working on survival, it's not changing that much. In terms of not having more options, you still start working.
Yeah. I mean, we're privileged. So we can talk about those options. With people a couple of economic steps below us, that still isn't an option.
And even women now, even women with children don't have the option to stay home with their children. They still have to go out and work.
Yeah, he says that there are women who go out and work, but there are also the idea of women who he calls who are married to the government, and the government takes over the role that the husband is supposed to have.
No, I'm talking about provider, married women with both male and female, both mom and father have to work.
Yes.
To keep the kids alive.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that exists. That exists.
More and more.
More and more, yeah, that exists. But still, there are a lot of those cases where the woman's salary is secondary to the man's salary, which means the man has an economic burden because he still has to pick up what her salary doesn't cover. He still has to pay for all the stuff for the kids, and his becomes an economic buffer, you know, for her, because if she loses her job, she still has his. Stage one, stage two. He talks about stage one, stage two, moving from one to the other. Stage one is survival. You know, we have these roles strictly for survival. The male protects, the woman stays with the children, does everything around the house that has to do with nurturing. The man goes out and makes sure that there's enough food, there's enough water, and nobody's going to take it. And he says our society is to the point where since the end of World War II, where we're moving to stage two, where the goal or the purpose is no longer survival but fulfillment. And there's a lot of tension and mixture that goes on with this idea of fulfillment. And some people are kind of stuck in survival, and a lot of the things, even scripture, is interpreted in terms of survival. And things change when you move towards fulfillment. Like he talks about dysfunctional families. Everyone's talking about dysfunctional families and how to hit a kid is wrong in a fulfillment society. But he says in a survival society, to hit a kid was not wrong, because you need for that kid to know that if his life wasn't going to be about survival, then there was pain involved. So he says to spare the rod and spoil the child made sense in a survival mentality. But in a fulfillment mentality, it becomes dysfunction.
I just read that section in his more expensive book. I didn't buy the book. I just read it over there. It talked about that both as marriage and as family. And marriage was, when you get married as a stage one marriage, that's the basis for stage two divorce.
Yeah.
You know, you may get married in a stage one setting and then you move to stage two. And becomes grounds for divorce.
Grounds for divorce. He talks about marriage as in a survival. You have this division of labor. The man working, the woman at home. But when you move into fulfillment, that doesn't work anymore. You know, that division of labor doesn't work anymore. And if you can't adjust to that, it leads to divorce.
And he says he doesn't want to use the word dysfunctional. It turns out, he said, like, a statistic that I read in the book is 97% of, or up to, he said, up to 97% of families, people who are in marriages now, came from what would now be called dysfunctional families of origin. And he said it's not, he doesn't want to use the word dysfunctional now. He says those were stage one functional rather than dysfunctional. They were functional at stage one. Families of origin, they would be dysfunctional viewed from a stage two perspective.
Yeah.
So you get rid of the word dysfunction.
Yeah. Let's see. We talked about this. Women can't hear what men don't say. One of the things he says over and over again is this phrase that men need to say what they're feeling about things. And he said that women who don't hear men when they talk about their feelings should be weeded out, just the way men who can't hear no should be weeded out. Rape. He talks about, let me pass this around too. He talks about rape, and that part of the thing with rape is that we're in a position now where we assume like woman is as an innocent victim. And he says, he cites a couple of studies that show anywhere from 27% to 60% of rapes are false. And he says that they're false for a number of reasons, but the main reason that he uses that they're false is because society won't allow women to initiate sex or to be sexual at an age when women want to be sexual. So he talks about that women, you know, these women who do lie for reasons that protects their place in society, that puts the fault on the maiden. So that's one of the things he says about rapes, and when you look at that, she kind of has a breakdown of what that's
about. Saying that women say that they were raped when they were born.
He says that some women say that they were raped, and it has been proven that they were not. And he says our society is set up that if a woman says she was raped, the man ends up in jail. Now, even if they find out she's lying, this man has served time in jail, you know. So his question throughout this book is then, you know, who has the power? You know, if a woman can get a man sent away on a false charge of rape, who has the power? And he cites the fact that in the famous case of Roe versus Wade, the woman who was Jane Roe, a woman named Jane McCarvin, 14 years later, she admitted that she lied. She admitted that she lied, and this guy, you know, had gone to jail, and her reason for lying was that she wanted an abortion. She wanted a legal way to get an abortion. And I'm certainly not saying that all rapes, that women are lying, that all rapes, and he's not saying that. He's just saying that as long as we look at women as innocent victims, we won't look at both sides of the story. I talked about men as success objects and water and food and that kind of thing. I would like to, because all week we've been dealing with this kind of stuff, and I would like to see if we could break up into small groups and come up with a list of solutions for this kind of thing. Now, let me get it straight. He is not denying the powerlessness of women in society. But what he is saying is that men need to own up to their powerlessness as well. And that when, you know, things like when only men go to war, when men work at jobs where there's 600% more possibility of being injured or killed, that is powerlessness. And that women don't have no problem expressing their powerlessness, but men seem to have a problem expressing ours. And that we need to pay attention to that.
Again, just reading a little bit about this. In the stage one setting, there's a no option male and a no option female. They both didn't have options. They had the roles.
Yeah.
You did the roles. That's the culture tells you what your roles are. You do them. No options. You know. And we want civilization to brought a situation around where men have worked their roles to the point where they liberated the women to have choices. They haven't liberated themselves to have choices, but the situation is now women now have more choices than they had in the past in their roles.
Yeah.
And so the women are moving to stage two faster than the men.
Than the men are. Yeah, that's true. And everybody knows what these roles are. And people reject those roles, particularly people in their teens and 20s. Reject the role that society has laid out. But, you know, the pressure of society is so great that by the time people are in their mid-30s, they've accepted those roles, and they just move right along. And the people, of course, who don't accept the roles are the people, number one, who can't make it work for them, who don't benefit because of it, for a number of reasons, or outside of the role thing. And we all know people like this. Sometimes age does it. Sometimes when people get older, they no longer care about these roles. They live a life contradictory to the role that's laid out. And there's all kinds of reasons why. But on the other hand, society no longer rewards those people. Your rewards is directly related to how well you play these roles. And society no longer rewards you if you don't play those roles. So, when people feel comfortable breaking up into small groups, coming up with solutions for this kind of stuff, or would you feel more comfortable just talking about it? Okay!
But I guess there is to know what is the truth. There's a certain freedom aspect of knowing.
We had a hard time stopping us.
Well, why don't we wrap it up? You know, those who are talking can finish, and then we can get together at a larger group.
To know that there is. In words of Norwell, the range of this human being, this diversity that we've been talking about here, is another part of truth telling. Has to stop. How many of my girls sitting here watching the lab?
We think that's somehow good. We can talk about society is changing the messages of the media.
Right.
The lab is
there's a book in there about the wife of the guy who had been in the museum or whatever. And she, this was in a town where there were no cars. And she was the one who drove the first car. 50 miles, we ran into the possibility. It became remarkable.
It's very great.
What are some solutions that you came up with?
Well, we talked about sex.
That's a good one.
I was in the wrong group.
That's a good one.
And what did we come up
with? More.
We talked about more.
More. Yeah. We came up with, I think, my perception of it is that a very hard thing to change. We started out on the discussion of rape, actually, I think, sexuality, and that it's, as a society, how do you make the changes in the attitudes? Because we also said that even though it's changing very, very slowly, there's still a lot of messages, even from the media, that are perpetuating the myth, and that until we can get
mostly
rid of
from
myth,
the media,
it's going to be very hard to change the attitudes. Such as we talked about Aladdin and Cinderella, the children of today are still being taught these myths. And,
excuse me, did everyone see this?
Yeah, I was lost.
Who was?
I was lost.
You saw it. Yeah. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that's okay. And because I don't know that it's a solution. This is kind of what we talked about.
So can you,
on the one hand, we're saying that the rules are changing very slowly,
mm-hmm.
and the attitudes are changing very slowly. On the other, we feel society is still perpetuating the myth by producing new movies like Aladdin and continuing to teach Cinderella to the children and read
the
stories.
What can you do in your families, in your society, in your communities?
Start with your kids.
Two things.
Start with your kids.
One, demythologize the myths. Don't let them be
the
whole story.
Okay.
And the second part about that, it seems to me, is to do the thing which is the hardest to do, which is share the story of your own sexuality and all of its confusing complexity over time so that there's some other reality, not just the myth.
Okay, good. That's one of the things he came up with, too, is that we should teach our children, number one, how to date, what that's about. But we should also teach our children how to be sexual. None of us have been taught. I've never been taught how to be sexual. I don't think that's uncommon.
And it starts with listening.
What?
It starts with listening.
Well, yeah.
Teach boys, teach girls to listen.
Yeah, yeah. And so that's one of the things he talks about. You know, that's something that needs to be taught. What did you come up with?
We came up with a. Everybody ought to. There's an awareness thing about this. You know, not everybody's here at Old Villages and Roland Brown talk about Warren Farrell. You know, there's a certain amount of awareness that this is what's going on. People might act differently if they had the information that, you know, women are not innocent victims, men are not all powerful. That's getting that message, having awareness of that message is one thing that would maybe speed up some movement. What else are we talking about? We're talking about being, you know, women don't even, men don't, women can't or men don't say, so men need to talk more. And I kind of said, and be honest about what they say rather than just say what women want to hear.
Yeah, a lot of men say what we think women want to hear. You know, I remember once, this is a little too revealing. I don't know if I want to share that.
You're among friends.
Yeah. I remember once this woman kept saying that she wanted a man who cried. And I remember faking crying at some point because this woman says she wanted
I faked it.
I haven't cried in years. I just don't cry. The last time I cried was 7 or 8 years ago at my mother's funeral. I just don't cry. I don't know why. I can't figure it out. You know, but I go for walks. You know, I listen to the same song over and over again. You know, I deal with it, but I just don't cry. But I faked it for that. Woman, maybe there should be a study between women who fake orgasms and men who fake crying. So, well, is there more? Is there more that people discussed? That I don't want to cut anybody off.
There's one other thing which we were really, I think, on children as much as sex. And the other possibility is, can you create the notion that boys have more options, that it's okay to think of other ways to design your life to honor that possibility, even if society doesn't.
I don't get it. I'm sorry.
Well,
I'm
not getting it. Create more options for boys than to think that the only thing they're ever going to do is work all their life.
Teach your son that he also has options.
Yeah.
As opposed to just teaching your daughter that she has options.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. Some of the things that he came up with is to adapt. You know, our survival is dependent on our ability to adapt. He says we simply can't go out and kill anymore without blowing up the whole earth as we know it. One of the interesting things that I think is going on is this whole thing with North Korea and Clinton. You know, there's Dole and his bunch who say we should give them an ultimatum, and if they don't do it, go to war. And Clinton is trying, you know, to discuss it. You know, Carter is there trying to discuss it. At least last time, you know, when I left, that's what was going on. I don't know what's going on now. But, you know, so he's saying that the idea of the man who's the killer, who goes out and kicks butt, either in the military or on Wall Street or wherever, he says, that can't really be done anymore if we expect to survive as a species, because everything is so interconnected, you know, that if, you know, if you kill over here, you're gonna feel it over there. So that's one thing he says. Another one is that men should protest. Men should protest, you know, what we consider our powerlessness. You know, we should protest the fact that, you know, he talks about being unpaid bodyguards, being as unpaid bodyguards, or we should protest the fact that, you know, we're dying. Make that connection between the fact that that we die 7 years earlier than women, that we die of the 15 leading diseases earlier than women, that our suicide rate is higher than women. See those connections and begin to protest in some way to say, I don't think I want to work a 50-hour week or 60-hour week.
Aren't a lot of those earlier deaths due to more stress?
Yes. And stress, he says, is caused from the men leaving their center, which is the home and the family and all of those things where we get lovability, to continue to spend 60 hours a week away from that. You know, he even talks about, he connects that to people who perform, which is what men have to do, but political people and musicians and various entertainers, you know, a lot of them died on the road, away from family, away from their center. You know, so yeah, that causes stress, which causes, you know, death from all of those other leading diseases. Anti-male sexism, protest against that. You know, protest against the fact that there's an office of female health, but there is no office of male health.
We can all do that. It doesn't have to be men.
Yeah. Protest. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. If it's a protest, you can join in. You know, I've never heard anyone say, we don't want you protesting with us. You know? But, I mean, you know, his thing is that society focuses on the fact that, you know, that there should be an office of health for women, but they don't pay any attention. And everybody says, oh, well, men have health anyway. You know, but his thing is, no, men don't have health. What men have is the fact that we're dying earlier and we're taught to keep our mouth shut about it. We don't talk about it. We don't talk about prostate cancer. We don't talk about testicular cancer. You know, we don't talk about that stuff. You know, the only thing that's out there is AIDS that men talk about. And the men who are talking about it, of course, are gay men,
or the
who
men
are disenfranchised anyway.
Yeah, or men talking about how only gay men get AIDS.
Yeah.
And degrading people who have AIDS.
Yeah. So, you know, that's another way he says we can handle it. Educate men. You know, women are educated to check their breasts for lumps. Men are not educated to check their testicles for lumps. You know? There's no big push. You don't see commercials. You don't see advertisements in newspapers and things about men checking themselves for, you know, for lumps and that sort of thing. And he says, you know, that has to do with the fact that, you know, once again, this whole thing that men don't talk about that kind of stuff.
Are women at a certain age start having mammograms every year?
Mm-hmm.
Should men be having some kind of a similar x-ray every year?
Nobody knows. The only thing they know is prostate, which happens at 40. Men should be checked regularly for that, and at 50 it should be every year. And that men who have had vasectomies are four times more likely to get cancer, prostate cancer, than men, you know, who don't. But he had a whole list of stuff, you know, it's like,
yeah,
why, you know, feminists assume that there's no birth control pill because men are obsessed with women's sexuality. But the reality of it is, he says, men don't, you know, men are disposable. So they don't care to look for a male's, you know, a male birth control pill. And he says it goes down the line with a lot of other stuff that the medical profession doesn't care to look at. He also talks about testing. Much of the testing for medicine has been done on men, military men, men in prison. He says if a man is tested, if a man dies, a woman lives.
Well,
if a man dies,
but
a woman
then the
or
drugs,
a child
I mean,
lives.
What if the drugs are just, I mean, there's a lot of discrimination against women. And
there's a downside.
Research.
Right, I was going to say there's to that too.
The other side of that is the women are saying this isn't right because the men are the only ones being tested, therefore they really don't know the effectiveness of
absolutely.
These drugs and treatments.
Absolutely, but
on
the men.
Women. So the women have
absolutely.
The opposite approach, which is.
Absolutely, but his thing is that the men are dying And he says, think about it. You
know,
we test mice because we don't want to kill humans. And we test men because we don't want to kill women and children.
The men who are tested for these things say are dying anyway. And say, I want to be tested.
It's because they're disposable. They're already in prison. They're already in the military. Their chances of dying are much higher than anybody else in the general population. So
they actually
right.
test people who don't want to be tested. Don't want to be part of a test.
Well,
sometimes they used to.
Think about this. Think about this whole thing that just happened in the desert. Those guys, the nuclear stuff.
Right here in Washington.
Yeah. Well, how do you think they tested for whether microwaves are safe or not to humans?
Yeah. So, you know, I'm not blaming women for this. I'm not saying this is women's fault.
I think this is a problem, period. It's not just a problem.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a problem, period. Yes. So, but we need to be educated about that. The whole thing about protecting women, we need to protect men. He says we haven't put as much energy in protecting men as we put into protecting women and children. You know, I mean, so that's one. He says heroes, making men heroes. Well, heroes are always the first to die. You know, whenever we put a man up as a hero, that man is going to get blown away sooner or later. You know, so... And so he talks about this hero stuff, and either we share it or we don't do it anymore. Violence Against Men Act. There's a Violence Against Women Act, but there is no Violence Against Men Act. And men are 3 times more likely to be victims of violence than women are. And you say, well, the men are committing the violence, but does that make it better? Does it feel better to you that you're killed by a man as opposed to a woman? I don't think it matters to me. You know? So he says we should look at that. And it talks about helplessness. That he says to think about the idea that if a woman murders a man because she feels helpless, wouldn't it make sense, too, that a man would murder a woman because he feels helpless? We assume that it's all an act of power. It's power over somebody, and that's part of it. But it's also a sense of helplessness that gets somebody to a position that he would want to harm somebody for temporary relief. And he says, we should look at what makes men feel helpless. Our society should focus on that and pay attention to that, just like it pays of trying to pay attention to what makes women feel helpless. Another thing he talks about is risk. To teach women to take the risk for initiating sex and intimacy. And he says, this amazes me, I've said it before, I don't know how he comes up with this 150, but he says there's 150 steps from eye contact to sexual contact. And men are expected to make all 150 steps.
But they don't.
She says,
absolutely. That's right. You're absolutely right. They don't.
And he says, right. You can do this on them. Yeah.
He says they don't. He says those who do have to shut off their feelings to do it. Because at any step along the way, a man can be rejected. And if you're a feeling man, that's going to hurt your feelings. So you learn to cut off your feelings, and oftentimes, the men who are willing to take those 150 steps are men who have shut off their feelings. And if the woman says no at any other point, at any point along the way, big deal.
Barrels ahead anyway.
Yeah, or find somebody else that he can, you know, that he can...
It's not that they continue when the men who continue are don't hear the no.
Those are the ones who have shut their feelings out. They don't hear the no. They got their blinders on and they have a goal.
Is he trying to say here? Can we reduce 150 to 15?
No, he is saying that if...
Okay,